I'm used to making that statement so that Phil Magnin can switch on the camera for the sermon up in Reading. When I lived in Boston, Massachusetts, I would occasionally be asked by visitors who came frequently to the area to guide them to some high points in the Boston area. One of those, is what they call the Freedom Trail, which was the trail that goes to the house of Paul Revere and many of the early settlers in our country, and some of the men and women who were responsible for planning the revolution and making this country what it is today. The second most popular site that I was asked to take people to was Cheers Bar. Because, of course, the TV show was pretty famous for many, many years. And most everyone that I took to the real Cheers Bar on Beacon Street, right on Copley Square, were very disappointed. Because it is extremely small and was always crowded. And when you took people down the steps into this little small bar, not the set that all of us saw on TV for the show, but the real Cheers Bar, very small, very crowded. I didn't think it was a very good experience, but some people, well, I want to have a beer in Cheers Bar. So they'd order a beer, and they'd have to yell to the bartender, who would pull a beer and pass it through the crowd to you in the back of the room. I just didn't think that was a very pleasant experience myself, but you do what people want you to do when they visit your town. The third most popular place that I was asked to take people was Newport, Rhode Island, which is about an hour south of Boston. And the reason people wanted to go to Newport, Rhode Island, most of the visitors were church members, was to visit the first Sabbath-keeping church in America, which is found in Newport, Rhode Island. The church has been moved from its original location on Spring Street to the hill, right next to the Historical Society. And they have preserved it to this day in pretty much the same condition it was at the end of the 17th century. It's a nice historical building to visit. What they're most interested in, though, is a tour of the graveyard in Newport, Rhode Island. Because in the graveyard of Newport, Rhode Island, are the graves of the seven founding members of that Sabbatarian church in 1671. Led by a very wealthy man who was an importer-exporter called Stephen Mumford. And so when you go there, you can find the graves. I knew where they were because Mr. Franks was the pastor in Boston before me, and he went down there with a weed whacker and chopped away the weeds in this old graveyard and discovered where these stones were, these memorial stones, and marked them on a little map that he drew, and he gave it to me when he left the area, and he said, here, you'll need this. And he was right. There were several people that we took to Newport. And there were the graves of Stephen Mumford, his wife Anne, their six children, and then his son Stephen Mumford, and his wife Elizabeth, and their children. They were all right there in a row, which was nice. And then if you walked around the graveyard, you found the graves of the other five people who were part of that seven founding members of the church. It's a little like going to Jerusalem, I guess. You know, because Stephen Mumford came from the Bell Lane Church of the Church of God in London. And when he got to Newport and settled in to prepare to import things from Britain into the deep water port of Newport, there was no church here. There was no place for him to gather. And so for the first few years, he met with the Baptist Church, which was the closest group that he knew of that resembled the days and the practices that we observed as a church, even in England. The only thing is they didn't meet on Saturday. So he met with them on Sunday. And then Saturday, he and his wife and children would meet in their home. And his son, Stephen Mumford II, followed suit. And after a while, the pastor of the Baptist church got upset because more and more people were wanting to gather with Stephen Mumford in his house on the Sabbath. And they became more and more convinced of the Sabbath. And eventually the Baptist pastor kicked him out with his family, and they founded that first Sabbatarian church in New England with those seven members initially, and it began to grow over the years. What is really remarkable is when you look at those gravestones in that yard, they don't tell a very complete story. And if you've ever gone into a graveyard and looked at the stones, you will notice the same thing that I did. A person's name, the date of their birth, and the date of their death is what is usually on a gravestone. Occasionally there's a pithy saying or a quote or two from the Bible, maybe. Not a whole lot is usually written on memorial stones, unless you're privileged or of rank or wealthy enough to have it printed. Most people have between their birth date and their death date a dash. And it seems so inadequate to describe a lifetime, doesn't it? Just a dash. One of those gravestones that is hand-carved on limestone, but still readable, was the stone of Roger Baster, B-A-S-T-E-R. It says, "Here lies Roger Baster, founding member of the Sabbath-keeping church in America." And after that it says blockmaker, and after that it says bachelor. And then his birth date, the dash, and his death date. It was hand-done, and there are some who assume it was done by Roger Baster himself, who was a blockmaker. And, of course, having block and tackle in a port city would be a very important position. And he made the blocks for all the temporary rope cranes that were used to take things off and on ships in the port of Newport, Rhode Island. Most of those original Sabbatarian members were only known by their name, their birth date, their death date, and that dash. And it seems so incomplete. Unless somebody comes along and writes a history book about you or me on our gravestone, what do you think is going to appear? Your name, your birth date, your death date, and that dash. It does seem so inadequate, doesn't it? I'd like to turn to Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 1. It's interesting, the book of Ecclesiastes is written by Solomon, the son of David. He's credited with writing this book towards the end of his life, expressing some of the frustrations of living a physical life and kind of glancing forward to his death. And some of that frustration comes out in many of the verses here found in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1. "A good name is better than precious ointment." Roger Baster wanted to be known as someone who was a founding member of that first Sabbatarian church in America. In order to ensure that, he had that chiseled, or he chiseled it on his own gravestone before his death. "A good name is better than precious ointment. The day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth." I remember several years ago when my middle son, our youngest son, was our middle child, our youngest son, was getting up for class. He was going to junior college at the time, and I had gotten up before him. I had breakfast, and I had my suit on, my black suit on. I was getting ready to go to a funeral down in San Diego, and my son came out of his bedroom and into the kitchen, and he goes, "Where are you going today?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to a funeral." And he goes, "Oh, bummer." And I says, "Well, you know, it says, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting." Now, when you're 19 and, you know, there's a lot of serotonin running through your brain, probably the most exciting thing you can think of doing is going to a party, right? And he said, "Well, who said that? That sounds kind of stupid." And I said, "It says it in the Bible." "Oh, oh, I see." It does seem odd to read this verse. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. You know, in the recent shadow of the death of Mrs. Teal, I thought it might be suitable for us to think about this issue of death and dying. Not a very pleasant thing to think about. I don't know about you, but I still remember when I was about 50 years of age, I started looking at the obituaries in the paper going, "Wow, they were young." And rarely do they put in there what people die from, you know, in the paper. It's almost like the dash, you know, what was their life like? At some point in time, if you haven't already done so, you will begin to think about your mortality and how many days you have left in this life. It happens to all of us. As the book of Ecclesiastes says, let's read some of these very wise sayings here by going back to chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes as we consider our own lives in the shadow of the death of a good friend, Dolores Teal. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 3 is where I'd like to begin. "What profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? What really lasts after a lifetime of labor? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever." Now, most of us probably don't lie awake at night thinking, you know, what kind of memorial are they going to build for me? Because we're just ordinary folk, right? And probably the best we can think of is a placard in a graveyard with our name and birth date and death date in a dash, right? They're probably not going to name a hospital wing about after many of us. Not a big memorial. Nobody's going to build a big tower in Washington, D.C. at the end of the mall that says, you know, "Here was where President Register lived." You know, I'm not disillusioned to know that or think that's going to happen. We realize that one generation passes another, another comes. The cycle of life continues over and over again, as it has, as we know, for 6,000 years. What kind of blip on the radar will we make? Not much. As the author of Ecclesiastes said, not much. Let's go to chapter 2, verse 17. Chapter 2, verse 17. "Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me. For all is vanity and grasping for wind." And that's what the word means. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, if you've got the King James Version. It just means you're grasping after something, but it's like wind. You know, if you reach out and try to grab the atmosphere in the room, what do you get? It's nothing. It's vacant. Grasping after wind. Verse 18, "Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me." And how many children really appreciate what we as parents give them, or what we as parents do for them, or what we as parents leave them? thought it was really interesting when Linda and I downsized, you know, from a 3,400 square foot home into a 1,200 square foot condominium. We tried to give our kids our furniture. I don't want that stuff, Dad. It's not my style. I worked a lifetime to collect this stuff. What do you mean? It's real wood. We don't like that stuff. And of course, as we downsized, our kids told us, well, we're glad you got rid of that stuff. Because when you die, we don't have to get rid of it, you know. We don't have to clean up after you, right? And yet that expresses a certain amount of frustration that I see here in verse 18. I hated all the labor in which I toiled under the sun because I must leave it to a man who will come after me. And sometimes succeeding generations just don't appreciate what we did to get them where they are. And oftentimes we spoil our kids, don't we? Because we want to give them things. We want them to have a better life than us, a better education. And it's sometimes not appreciated as much as it should be. We all know that. There's a lot of spoiled little rich kids running around, aren't there? I still remember in that town of Newport, Rhode Island, not too far from that cemetery I described to you, are the homes, the summer homes, of many of the rich industrialists who lived primarily in New York City, the founders of railroads, shipping lines, giant steel companies, construction companies. And they had their summer homes, their summer cottages in Newport, Rhode Island. The Vanderbilts, the Carnegies, you know, names you would immediately recognize. Their summer homes were just modest places, 50, 60 bedrooms, on the coast, you know, in Newport, Rhode Island. And if you ever get to Newport, don't just see the graveyard. Go by and see some of these mansions, which is quite a contrast. They're beautiful. They've all been donated by those families to the Newport Society of History, and they're now maintained by the Newport Historical Society. And for a small fee of about $10, you can go in and tour these homes now. It's an interesting tour. But what really struck me was the Vanderbilt mansion or home. Like I said, this was a summer home. Their main home was in New York City. And what they'd do is they'd load up their silverware and their cutlery and all their china and their servants, and they would bring them by train from New York City to Newport, Rhode Island for the summer and invite all their friends up for the summer. And that's the way the rich lived, you know, in the 19th century. But oftentimes, you would see busts inside the home of, I think, of the Vanderbilt mansion, because Mrs. Gloria Vanderbilt just passed away recently in her 90s. Maybe some of you saw that in the news. But she was raised in that house in the summer. And in the library is a bust of her brother, who looks a great deal like Anderson Cooper, who is, of course, her son on CNN. And when I looked at the bust, I went, oh, that's Anderson Cooper. Well, no, it's his uncle. It was the brother of Gloria Vanderbilt. And if you read the label at the bottom of the bust of this young man, it says that he lived 21 years and he died while he was at university. And I thought, here were people who had millions of dollars at the time, and they, like many other families, had their sons die when they were young. They didn't survive. In fact, many of those graveyards you go to in Rhode Island, a lot of those sailors, you know, you see the big gravestones and you see a lot of little ones that go down like almost like stair steps. And it reflected that in those days, without the kind of medicine that we have today, a lot of those families had children who died. They would have 8 or 10 kids with these little bitty gravestones, and their kids would die before they got to be 10 or 12 years of age. It was really tragic. But it struck me that the Vanderbilts, with all their millions of dollars, could not save the life of their son. And, of course, that happened many times over, as we all might imagine. Money doesn't buy you fame, does it? Sometimes it doesn't even buy you longevity of life. Let's go to chapter 2, verse 17. We read that, "Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing." Futile. It's a good word. Let's drop down to verse 21. Verse 21. "For there's a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and great evil." When our family lived in Pasadena, California, we lived on a lot that was owned by the church at that time, which was later razed, and that's where they built the auditorium. Behind us was a little house, a little cottage that was also rented by another family. They had a son who's same age as me. We're still good friends to this day. But his father was a plasterer. Now, most of you probably haven't heard of a plasterer, but a plasterer was a man who spread plaster over lath, that's little wood strips in a wall, and had the ability and the skill to smooth it beautifully against the wall. And he could actually take plaster and he could make a crown molding by hand around the room that was flawless. I mean, this was a skilled artisan. And he had learned the art from his grandfather and his father, and it had been passed down for generations. These men were plasterers. You know, they knew how to smooth a wall to make it look like glass, to make it straight. Of course, the reason most of us haven't heard of that, maybe I'm giving my age away a little bit, is that today you have drywall. And you have guys that come along, you know, with a spatula, and they stick, you know, a little bit of compound over the screws, and they scrape it, and then they put texture on it, and then they prime it, and they paint it, and that has replaced those artisans who did plaster walls at one time. And it's sad that this man was the last of the plasterers, about four generations. And new technology came along that we call drywall in the construction business, and it replaced the plasterer, the real artisan. And it's harder to find artisans these days, isn't it, that really have a skill set that is wonderful. Right now we're remodeling our condo. All of you probably know that. And there is an artisan who is putting up our tile in our bathroom. And he's very precise. And I've been over there several times to watch him. He's slow, and he works by the hour, which kills my wallet, but he's an artist. And he takes a great deal of pride in what he does in his work. And I like his work. But he was complaining to me that there aren't very many artisans even in the tile-laying business anymore. You know, people like to take shortcuts, and they like to be masters of all trades. And nobody specializes like they used to. And a lot of times these skills are lost to the next generation. And I think that's part of what the frustration that's coming through these pages illustrates. Ecclesiastes 3, there's verse 21. "There is a man whose labor is with wisdom and knowledge and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is grasping for wind." Verse 22, "For what has man for all his labor, and for the striving of his heart, with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful, his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is grasping for wind." Nothing is better, verse 24, "for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God." He understood that God wanted us to realize that this life is temporary. You know, when you're 19, you don't think it's temporary. You think you're going to live forever, right? You don't really care. It's all that serotonin flowing through your bloodstream. You know, you think, yeah, you know, I can do anything. I don't know when it was that you hit the wall. Maybe you haven't yet. But I remember when I kind of realized, hey, I'm not getting younger. I'm getting older, and I better stop doing stupid things. I was going down the Snake River in a canoe with a buddy. It was in the spring of the year, and the water was high in the Snake River. There were large haystacks rolling over, water rolling over the stones. The haystacks were about 5 feet high, and we were in a canoe. And that's when I learned about a confluence in a river. If you don't know what a confluence in a river is, as a canoeist, you soon learn. A confluence is when the river flows around a sandbar or a small island, and when the two sides of the river come together on the bottom side of the sandbar, it creates a confluence. That is where there's a current on top of the water and a current under the water that are going in opposite directions. And it sometimes creates a big wave, a big splash. It's a confluence in the river. Now, when you're in a canoe, you want to look for these because if you're not careful, you might glide over the top on the first flow, but the flow underneath from the confluence coming from the other direction will hit the bottom of your canoe and flip you over. So we're coming down the Snake River. Both of us are experienced canoeists, and we hit the confluence, and it flipped our canoe. And when you flip out of the canoe, you come out of the water, and you look ahead of you, and you try to make sure that there's no rocks. You don't want to get stuck. If you get your ankle stuck in a rock, you're a dead person. There's no way to rescue you, basically, because the flow of the river is going about 30 miles an hour, and nobody can unhook you in a case like that. So you immediately pull your feet up because, of course, you don't want to get your foot stuck in the rocks, and you want your feet in front of you in case you roll over one of those stacks and hit another rock. You will absorb the shock with your legs. So we're now flowing down the river. I'm looking for the canoe because I don't want to get hit by the canoe. And I see my buddy with the canoe, and I grab the oar. Thankfully, we've got life vests on, and we're going down the Snake River over these haystacks. And I'm trying to stay afloat, trying to avoid the big rocks. And that went on for about a mile and a half till finally I had enough energy to get to the shore. Well, I got to the shore, canoe in one hand, breathing deeply, finally stood up on tierra firma. Thought I was going to kiss the ground. It was so nice to be on the shore of the river. And I looked up, and there was my buddy. He had landed on a sandbar with the canoe, and he was looking over at me, and he said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "I thought I was going to die." He said, "Me too." And then he pointed. And he pointed at me, and I pointed back at him. And he pointed at me again, and I turned around and looked, and there was a bear cub about 15 feet away coming down the bank of the river onto the bar of rocks where I was. And, of course, if you know anything about wilderness exploring, you know that where there's a bear cub, there's a mama bear nearby. I looked back. I saw the cub, curiosity-filled, coming down towards me. I immediately told the man on the sandbar, "Throw me a rope," which he had in the canoe, and he unwound the rope. He threw it across the water to me. I grabbed it, and he pulled me into the water. I didn't think I was going to go back in the water again, period, after the experience I had. He pulled me over to the sandbar, and when we got there, we looked back, and sure enough, Mama Bear came down to the edge of the river and looked at us, looked at her cub. And I was beginning to plan my exit. Plan. I'd rather go in the river than be subject to the anger of a she-bear. And I'm sure you all understand what I'm talking about. Well, she thankfully didn't think we smelled very good. She was there for the berries anyway. And she turned back up on the bank and took her cub with her. And we got back in our canoe and shakily went down to the nearest outpoint. And at that point, I decided no more canoe trips down the Snake River in the springtime for me. I am not as young as I used to be. And it was at that time, I was 55 years old. I go, "I'm getting too old for this. We need younger ministers to escort kids down the river." Now, we were just going down the river to see if it's safe for kids. And we decided it wasn't. So we went back to camp and said, no, we're not going down the Snake River. But at some point, if you haven't already been there, you'll come to this point where you realize, I'm not getting any younger. I'm getting older, and I'm kind of reaching a peak, and I'm reaching a point where, hey, you know, I better slow down a little bit. That's wisdom, right? Let's go to chapter 5 of Ecclesiastes. Chapter 5 and verse 10. Ecclesiastes 5:10, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. As somebody once said, you can't take it with you when you go, can you? He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. Nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is grasping after wind. It's kind of interesting. I don't know if you know who the richest man in the world is. He's an American, Jeff Bezos, considered the richest man in the world, the founder of Amazon. This year he was named the richest man in the world. He's worth $131 billion. Did that make him happy? Did that give him a happy marriage? Well, no. This year, as maybe some of you know, he got divorced. His wife, Mackenzie, divorced him. Her settlement gave her $38 billion. And guess what? Mackenzie Bezos is the richest woman in the world now. Money doesn't buy you happiness, does it? It's kind of interesting. I was talking with Mr. Zimbrick, who was kind of taken under the wings of an elderly gentleman because he helped him repair a few apartments that he owned. And it turns out this gentleman didn't have any kids. He didn't have a wife. After a while, his wife died. And he owned a lot of apartment buildings in Sacramento. And Mr. Zimbrick helped him do the electrical work. And after a while, after several years, this man grew to trust Mr. Zimbrick and asked him to be the executor of his estate, or actually the primary trustee of his trust. And he said the man was a hoarder. You know, he saved everything. He had these storehouses where if he found something on sale, he wouldn't buy just one, he'd buy three. You know, so he had these warehouses full of things, and he had all kinds of collectibles, carpets. You know, he owned these apartment buildings, so when people moved out in the middle of the night and left their furniture, he'd take that and put it in his warehouse. I mean, he's just a collector of things. Do you know people who like to collect things? Well, just about all of us like to collect things, right? Well, when he died, Mr. Zimbrick was responsible for liquidating his estate. And it's interesting, he left everything in his estate to a college back in Washington, D.C., that he went to school at. It was over $2.5 million. He spent all this time collecting it. And when he died, guess what? He couldn't take anything with him. All those things he collected had to be cleaned up by somebody else. We all know how it works, right? Verse 11, Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 11. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? Talk about the concept of inflation. We say the dollar isn't what it used to be, right? It certainly isn't. Verse 12. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not allow him to sleep. Scrooge lays awake at night wondering who's trying to break into his millions, right? There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt, but those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. We came in with nothing, we'll go out with nothing. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Mr. Zimbrick described this elderly gentleman in his last days, and he died an angry, lonely, sour man. Sadly. Here's what I have seen. Verse 18. It is good and fitting for one to eat, to drink, to enjoy the good of all of his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for that is his heritage. That is his heritage. It's kind of interesting. I don't know if any of you watched, probably didn't. I only watched a few highlights of the debate of the Democratic contenders for the presidential nominee. And one of them said that Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett, three richest men in America, have accumulated more wealth than the entire bottom half of all Americans. Three men possess more wealth than 175 million people in America. That's pretty staggering, isn't it? What good is it going to do them? What good will it do them? Let's go to Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 2. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 2. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked. To the good, the clean, and the unclean. It's like that old song, the good, the bad, and the ugly. It happens to them all. To him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice, as is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath as he who fears an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that, they go to the dead. They go to the dead. After that, they go to the dead. But for him who has joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. And they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. The memory of them is forgotten. It's kind of like the dash. Before we moved to Boston, we lived in a little place called Lewis, Delaware. And I went down to the graveyard there. You probably went, this register's a crazy guy. He's going to graveyards all the time. And in this graveyard, I found a fellow by the name of Elijah Register. His name was on a tombstone, and his birth date and his death date were on there, and the dash was there. And I wondered, is this a distant relative? Is this somebody? You know, Register is not a very common name. And I went to the local church. I went to the Historical Society. I went all over town trying to find out who this guy was and what he did and whether or not we were connected in some way. Couldn't find a thing. Couldn't find a thing. He was somebody named Register who lived a couple hundred years ago, and nobody knows anything about it. The memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, verse 6, their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. So go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart. For God has already accepted your works. Let your garments also be white. Let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity. For that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hands finds to do, do it with your might. for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. We know the truth about that, don't we? I was struck by something else I saw in the news this week. President Trump gave the highest decorated honor to a soldier. That is the Medal of Honor to the only living soldier in the Iraqi war. And this young soldier, middle-aged now, did something very heroic in war. And he was being acknowledged by the president. And his grandfather was in one of the soldiers that landed at Normandy. And this was brought out in the story that was being repeated before the ceremony. Anyway, President Trump, he said something I thought was pretty interesting. He said, "Your grandfather is up there in heaven looking down with pride upon you now." It's a common misconception, isn't it? We think when people go to heaven, you know, they're sad or happy or rejoicing with what's happening now. And yet the Bible says there's nothing going on with the dead. They're all waiting for a resurrection. You and I know that, right? That's why Solomon wrote, there's nothing going on there. There's no thoughts, no happiness, no sadness, no rejoicing yet. But there will be. But we know that the dead are dead, as David is still in the grave waiting for the resurrection. Let's go to chapter 12, Ecclesiastes 12. And verse 7. Ecclesiastes 12:7. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. And we know that spirit, the spirit in man, will be reunited with a spiritual or physical body in the resurrection. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. A striving after wind. Basically, people who live with only the physical hope in life, it's just striving after wind. And after it's over, it's gone. Notice verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. Now we seem to be getting to the conclusion of the matter. And that is that there is something in this life that is important that's in that dash. Let's go to Psalms 90. Psalms 90, it was something that the writer of Ecclesiastes didn't expound upon very much. He was reflecting the frustration of the physical life as he got near the end of it. Psalms 90, verse 1. Psalms 90, verse 1. Lord, You have been our dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were brought forth or ever You had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting. You are God. You turn man to destruction. We just read about all that. That's the cycle of life. And You say, return, O children of men, from dust to dust. For 1,000 years in Your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night, You carry them away like a flood. They are like a sleep. In the morning, they are like grass that grows up. In the morning, it flourishes and grows up. In the evening, it is cut down and withers. For we all have been consumed by Your anger, and by Your wrath we are terrified. You have set our iniquities before You, our secret sins in the light of Your countenance. For all our days have passed away in Your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. The days of our lives are 70 years. And if by reason of strength they are 80, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow. for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. That spirit returns to God. Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. And verse 12, I'd like us to notice verse 12. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. That's what I'd like to do for the balance of our message today. Number our days. Mrs. Teal's life is finished. She's waiting the resurrection. She's no longer in pain, which she suffered with a great deal. She's resting and waiting for her resurrection. What about us? That's what the psalmist seems to be saying. Teach us to number our days. So I think it's appropriate in the shadow of the death of one of our friends, somebody we knew, to think about what's in that dash for us. What's really important? Is it our job? Is it the money we collect? Is it the things we own? Is it the houses we buy, the cars we drive in? What's important in life, really? You know, they've interviewed a lot of retired executives, and not one of them says, I wish I would have spent more time in the office. Not a one. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians 4. Verse 6. 2 Corinthians 4, 6. For it is the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness, who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Continues on. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. We are hard pressed on every side, yet not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body of the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus may also be manifest in our body. For we who live are always delivered to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our mortal flesh. What Paul is saying is the important things are spiritual, not physical. That was the frustration that Solomon reflected in Ecclesiastes. The important things are not the physical things, they're the unseen things, the spiritual things. Let's notice verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, like the psalmist said, 1,000 years is like a day. That means a life of 75 years is less than 2 hours in God's eyes, according to that analogy. It's a light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary. That was reflected in the words of the author of Ecclesiastes. Striving after wind was the refrain at the end of each one of the observations. But the things which are not seen are eternal. Brethren, what we must be concerned with are the unseen things. That is the most important. And sometimes when we think about death and life, I think this is where we need to focus our attention. What's really important? Is it not that we have a relationship with God? That's the only thing that will last. There are two things that the New Testament emphasizes: a relationship with other people, with God in the picture, and our relationship with God. That's what's really important. That's what Paul talked about. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 5. I'd like to end here. Ephesians 5 and verse 14. Ephesians 5:14. Therefore, he says, awake, you who sleep. There's coming a time when we know that Mrs. Teal will be resurrected. There's coming a time when all of our loved ones will be resurrected in a resurrection. Awake, you who sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. See then that you walk circumspectly, knowing what is really important, not so much the physical, but spiritual. Not as fools, but as wise. Redeeming the time, as we read in Psalms 90, numbering our days, thinking about what is really important. Redeeming the time because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. Speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. What is really important in life? I think we all know, don't we? It's the spiritual, our relationship with God and one another. That's what that dash represents. Like I said, if we die before Christ returns, that's probably what will be there on that plaque or that stone in a graveyard for us, is our name, the date of our birth, the date of our death, and that dash. The question is, what does that dash represent for us? A lifetime of collecting things? A lifetime of laboring in vain? Or a lifetime of building a relationship with God? And it is often in the shadow of the death of a friend that God asks us to stop and think about what is really important in life. What does that dash represent for you and me?